is Facundo. We are in Diálogos. This time we are with Neil Kinnock. Neil Kinnock's most notable role was as the leader of the Labour Party. He served as Member of Parliament from 1970 to 1995. He was Vice President of the European Commission from 1999 to 2004, and he was elevated to the House of Lords as Baron Kinnock in 2005, and he is still a prominent figure in British politics. So, hello Neil, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Good to see you. But nobody's given me any shock therapy, so I'm bound to be a little bit better than most people in Argentina.
I clearly understand that Argentina is having a very, very difficult time, and I guess that anything that happened in the Labour Party in the so-called wilderness years was better than what is happening in Argentina right now.
Even though, in some ways, of course, we were subjected to a similar body of policy. I mean, I'm not expert in Argentine politics, and I'm not going to go into it now, but it does seem to me that the current new regime is seeking to follow some of the philosophy and applied politics of Mrs. Thatcher. And I do not recommend that, because our country, all these years later, is suffering the legacy in terms of housing, economic performance, productivity, output, international trade, all kinds of problems. So I hope that they are not in store for your country.
Well, actually, that was one of the questions that I was going to ask. So I'm not going to the Thatcher's legacy right now. What I wanted to do as a start is with something nicer. Is your relationship with Michael Foote, and how was that? It was something like a mentorship and respect. I know it was like a transition in the party's direction, but how can you think about Michael Foote now in 2024?
He was a lovely man, a great individual with marvelous integrity and lots of courage. But he was also a great creator, because he was recognized, even by enemies, as a supreme writer, as a journalist, and as a biographer, and as a reviewer. And of course, on his feet, he was amongst the most brilliant speakers of his generation. So he had great accomplishments, but it was his comradeship that I always cherished. I've never had a mentor, and he certainly wouldn't regard himself to be any kind of a tutor or mentor or avuncular figure. We had our differences. We had very strident quarrels. I could go into some of the detail of that, but whatever policy differences we had, we never had a flaw in our friendship, largely because he was such a generous and considerate individual who profoundly believed in freedom of expression. And the last thing that he would have ever wanted to do is to try to curtail my freedom of expression. And I certainly always supported his freedom of expression. So he was a dear, dear, dear friend, and a man of great capacity, who was dealt a very tragic hand in many ways. I sought to persuade him, without any resistance really, not to run for the leadership of the Labour Party, because I knew it would be purgatory. But others prevailed on him, including his dear wife, Jill, who was I also loved very much. And he decided it was his duty to run, and he did run, and he won. And then the purgatory arrived, largely because some of those who had urged him to run immediately started to treat him as if he was some kind of right-wing alien, instead of a man who was trying to modernize and change the Labour Party and its policies so that the respect and support of the electorate could be regained. So he endured that for about 3 years. And the results, of course, were catastrophic in electoral terms. But what he did was enable the Labour Party to continue to exist. And that meant that when I succeeded him, I had to finish the job, really, in some ways dramatically, in other ways gradually, but over the years profoundly. And I'm quite proud of that. But if he hadn't sustained the existence of the Labour Party as a political force, nothing could have been done.
So you say that if Michael Foot wouldn't be if he in other aspect wouldn't have been elected, the Social Democrats or the Gang of Four would in other aspect will have achieved their objective of finish with the Labour Party.
That's right. I don't know how much your listeners know about the intimate detail of British politics in the 1980s, but a group split off from the Labour Party and formed the Social Democratic Party, the SDP, under the leadership of very distinguished, indeed a man I respected, Roy Jenkins. And altogether about 28, I think, Labour MPs left the party and joined the Social Democrats, some of them very able people, some of them complete duds who were in danger of being deselected from their seats. But the SDP attracted a great deal of support because, as my wife, in fact, gave the definition, they were Labour without the trade unions and with the nuclear bomb. And consequently, for about a year, they rode very high in the polls, they won by-elections, and they were a real threat to the Labour Party, so much so that by 1987, one of my main functions in leading my party into the general election was to try to ensure that we retained, at very least, retained second place. And we did manage to push the Social Democrats, by then allied with the Liberal Party, into third place. And within 2 years, we completely finished them off by devastatingly defeating them in by-elections, local council elections, and so on. But until 1987, they were a real threat. Now, Michael did everything he could to negotiate with the people who were going to defect to the Social Democrats. He did it with patience, he did it with courtesy, he did it with intellectual strength, and he did persuade some not to go. But others were completely lost. And he therefore had to face opponents on two fronts, not just the Tories in government, but the Social Democrats in opposition. And he did it with immense courage and a great deal of fortitude, which really managed to sustain Labour as a party that genuinely could claim to be on the left, but appealing to the centre of British politics as well. And He deserves great, great respect for that.
Well, actually, I was thinking that I failed to see the point if I am comparing your leadership with the STP, because you were saying that it was like the labor without the unions and without the nuclear bomb, and that is what actually. Oh,
Because
sorry,
at the
yeah.
time, Labour was in favour of the Labour Party policy was to favour unilateral nuclear disarmament, which was a policy, amongst several others, that I had to get changed. That took me 6 years, 5 to 6 years, because, of course, with issues like armaments and defence, you don't just get people adopting political positions, they become almost religious in their zeal. And so you've got to not just shift their votes, but move their deeply held beliefs. So it took quite a lot of time, but we managed to do that. The same thing applied in some other areas, like our relationship with the European Union and so on. So that was an uphill struggle, but one of the appeals, as you identified, of the Social Democratic Party was that they weren't associated with the trade unions, that electorally were very unpopular, wrongly in my view, but I understand why, and that they were in favor of retaining the nuclear deterrent.
Yes, but what I was saying is that if like a purgatory happened in the Labour Party, I think that what you're saying is that it was better to do the purgatory within the Labour Party and not outside of it, not in a war with the Social Democrats. Like it was better to do it
Yes,
inside the Labour Party.
that's right. In a first-past-the-post system, as you understand, parties that divide into factions are always weakened. But if they formalize that division into splitting off and forming a separate party, they further diminish the possibility of overthrowing the establishment party. And of course, that was borne out by the result of the 1983 and indeed the 1987 election, and come to that to a degree the 1992 election. I can give you the figures. In 1983, Labour got just under 30% of the vote, and the Social Democrats and Liberals got about 26% of the vote. So between the two parties in 83, they got well in excess of 50%. And Mrs. Thatcher was then elected in a party that hadn't divided, with 43% of the vote, getting, of course, a massive majority of over 140 in the House of Commons. And 100% of the power, which she used 150%. So everybody in a first-past-the-post democracy understands the danger, in my view, the great foolishness of dividing parties. And it massively profited the Conservative Party, of course.
But also in, for example, in 1985, in your well, in your Labour speech conference, when you criticizes the leadership of the Liverpool City Council for their extreme policies and actions, and when you took a firm a stand firm against the militant tendency, actually the Trotskyist faction. Isn't that like modernizing the Labour Party in a sense that okay, so we have to work in a agenda that is not Thatcher, but is like the what the world is dictating. We cannot go with the old left.
That's right. But they weren't really the old left, you see. As you say, they were a Trotskyite faction, an interest faction, all over the world, including, I think, probably in Argentina. People are familiar with ultra-leftists who profoundly believe, wrongly, of course, but nevertheless, some of them sincerely, that conditions have to become immensely bleak and damaging before the working class will develop consciousness and rise up against the cause of their oppression, exploitation, and disadvantage. And of course, in my view, that's always been fantasy and has been shown to be fantasy time and time again. But this idea of what's called revolutionary pessimism does take hold amongst some people, otherwise quite intelligent people, because it's got a certain romantic and absolutist appeal. And people who adopt dogma, who come close to bigotry in their politics, only have to make up their mind once in their lives, generally speaking, when they're quite young. And then, of course, they measure all developments, all events, indeed all other people, by whether they are conforming to that dogma. And of course, that is ridiculous. You can't bring up kids or drive a car or make a cup of tea on that basis. But nevertheless, there are people who consider that. They also think that the advance of socialism has to be total and complete in order to be satisfactory. And of course, that's rubbish as well, because as my great political hero, and that attitude is shared by many other people, Nairin Bevan, democratic socialist, made very clear that the advance, the victory of socialism, doesn't have to be complete in order to be very substantial. But those who are looking for perfection are obviously or often the enemies of gradual and tolerable and irreversible advance. And they can, from time to time, if they're quite well organized, really get in the way. So in attacking the militant tendency and their interest tactics, I not only had to defeat them constitutionally, which was an arduous business inside the Labour Party constitution, which is understandably and rightly a very generous, broad constitution, very tolerant of diverse beliefs and convictions. That's right, that's how it should be. But these people were abusing the privileges given to them as members of the Labour Party. And so I had to deal with them constitutionally. But more specifically, I had to persuade large parts of the Labour Party that in order to secure the votes of a broad spectrum of the public, there were tactics and antics that simply could not be tolerated because they alienated normal, well-disposed people, as they did. And that if we were really going to get an opportunity to put our ideals into practice, to make our principles the law of the land, we were going to have to take the people with us instead of accepting the delusion that the day would come when the public will be full of revolutionary fervor. Anyway, over the years, I managed to do that. By 1992, the party was electable, but it was Tony Blair that got us elected 5 years after that.
Yes, but what I was thinking, actually, is that Tony Blair and Keir Starmer are, in a way, like Kinnock's wing of the party, and the loony left still has like a wing, and that is Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know if you think in that way.
Yes, the thing is, the Corbynite attitude, which I've just broadly described, well-intentioned, but detached from the realities with which most people live, and antagonistic to codes of behavior, attitudes, conventions that people accept, harmless conventions, really. That's just part of the warp and weft of normal life. That Corbynite attitude always has existed, always will exist in probably every socialist movement. And it's largely composed of people, not Trotskyite militant interests, but decent, sane people who want and insist upon dramatic declarations in the belief that it will secure dramatic progressive advance. And that's not the real world.
Like
But
an
I don't quarrel with
anti-market.
their sincerity. I quarrel with their common sense, which, of course, if you abandon that in democratic politics, you truly are lost. Common sense is pretty rare, but it's absolutely vital.
You know what? When I was well, I'm a big fan of British politics, so I'm going into a very detail here, but one of the tactics that you used was being well. One was the rose, like entering the rose in the Labour Party as a symbol, and the other one was to be more appealing to the media. I don't know how you took caricatures like spitting image or shows like that.
Well, it goes with the territory. And Spitting Image was, in terms of its productions, generally fairly favorable to me. I mean, they made mock and they were satirical and so on. But in a democracy, if you can't take that, you should go and live elsewhere. The only damaging bit of it, and when I've spoken to the people who made the programs in later years, they've all been quite apologetic, really. They used, for the years that they were broadcasting, every Sunday night, an opening title which showed me falling on the beach in Brighton on the day I was elected leader of the Labour Party. And I mean, the tale behind that is quite amusing. My wife, my darling wife, had new grey suede boots. And they were beautiful boots. And she looked very smart in them. And at the suggestion of the photographers, we went for a stroll along the beach in Brighton, with the sea on our left and Brighton town on the right. And the beach in Brighton is shingle, and the tide was coming in. And when the water threatened to get near to the beautiful grey suede boots, my wife leapt out of the way. Unnecessarily, the water wasn't actually lapping over her boots. It missed her by about half a metre. But in doing that, she bumped into me. And I lost my footing, which I instantly regained, rather heroic, and then gave an indecent sign to the cameras. And we laughed at it. And that incident passed off. But of course, when it was shown every Sunday night for years, it gave the impression of a complete clown. And the people who made the program didn't recognize that. I knew it was the case, The worst thing was my children had to go to the local comprehensive school every Monday. And of all of the problems they encountered, which I guess included various kinds of physical threats and so on, and on a few occasions meant that we had to ensure a police guard that they knew never knew about. They never knew about it, following them to school. But I mean, that was incidental. It was largely because of the emergency in Northern Ireland and the provisional IRA and the armed so-called loyalists. But they had to endure the mockery of their schoolfellows from my son was aged 13, my daughter was aged 11. So they said it was very character forming, but it was bloody awful for them. They never, ever told us, not until years and years and years later, when they were fully grown adults and graduated from university and so on. Then they told us. So that was the only damage. But in terms of presentation, I adopted the rose as the symbol for Labour, red rose. I got the design from one of my father-in-law's rose catalogues. He was a lovely gardener and grew roses. And I got a design adapted from that. And the conventional, traditional element in the Labour Party on the National Executive Committee would have resisted it because it was change. You couldn't have, good God, a Socialist Party with change. Good God, he couldn't have that. So I didn't even tell them. We just launched it. And of course, there was hell to pay, but I quite enjoyed that fight. And as far as the press was concerned, the media, most of the press in Great Britain, in the United Kingdom, is very, very firmly associated with the right wing and the Conservative Party. So I knew that if we were going to make any appeal at all, it had to be through TV and broadcasting. So I tended to concentrate on that. And on that, we fought the Conservatives at least to a draw. And while they were spending millions, we had very little money to spend. But because of the talent that we could recruit, Oscar winners and people of huge reputation in the cinemas and in the theatre, we did pretty well. We frightened them to death, I have to tell you that, the Tories. But in the end, they still squeaked home.
And how did you deal with the ideas of nationalisation and the relationship with trade unions, with the old relationships with trade unions?
Yes. Well, trade unions are fundamental to the British labour movement. I've been a trade unionist since I was 16. I still belong to the same union. Trade unions have been one of the vital elements in advancing the condition of my family over the last three generations, and they still are. Indeed, in some ways, in this age of automation and artificial intelligence and climate challenge, trade unions, organizations of workers, are probably as important as they've ever been. But Thatcher introduced a variety of laws, some of which were draconian, stupid, ideological offenses against organized labor, and contradicted human rights, in my view. Others were just sensible provisions in a democracy for voting in the secret ballot for union leaderships, for strike action and so on. So what I had to do was to persuade the trade union movement not to issue a blanket unconditional condemnation of everything Thatcher had done, but to be selective in its demands for change. And eventually we all agreed upon a program. And by 1990, had decided on a formula which recommended itself to the trade union movement and the Labour Party, and ultimately recommended itself to the general public, because it's what Tony Blair was elected on in 1997 with a massive majority, and he proceeded to make the decent reforms. So that was essential because the conduct of trade unions or trade unionists at various times in the 1960s, 70s, 80s had really breached trust in the general public. And it wasn't so much the actions they took. People are entitled to go on strike, and that's almost universally accepted in the British electorate. But some of the leaderships that struck demagogic postures and were seen on television as being a threat to normality and stability. Some of them would have liked to have been, others were misrepresented. So we had to clear that out of the way before we could get people to hear our sane arguments on economics, the conduct of industrial relations, the safeguarding of civil rights, and so on and so forth. Anyway, we eventually achieved that, and Tony Blair made the necessary changes, which are still pretty much in place, even though in recent years, in desperation and looking for enemies to defeat, the current Conservative government has made further changes which are not conducive to good industrial relations or indeed to civil rights.
Okay, so one of the things that was essential for your career in Labour Party was your response to the 1984-85 miners' strike. So it was kind of controversial within the party because you were really criticized. So how would you reflect that, well, those years, you know, that many years ago?
I'll take you back to a few months before the strike. In late 1983, two things occurred. One, I had a meeting with Arthur Scargill, the president of the National Union of Mine Workers, who had never been a friend, but nevertheless was the leader of a major trade union, one that my father, my uncles, my grandfathers had both belonged to, and was very substantial in my constituency, where I had over 4,000 workers in the coal mining industry. So naturally, I was sympathetic to the miners' case for preventing unnecessary closure of collieries, knowing, as everybody did, that coal mining is an extractive industry, and eventually, in every colliery, exhaustion or increasing danger makes the pit unworkable. Everybody knows that. So in that meeting with Scargill, we agreed that it would be good if during the forthcoming work to rule in the industry, miners who were taking time out should go around the country to the non-coal mining areas in order to pamphlet and explain and hold meetings demonstrating how vital coal was to the operation of normal life, both in terms of industrial production and in terms of civilized existence in homes and schools and hospitals and shops. And he thought that was a good idea. And indeed, when the work the rules started in November, some of the coal fields, including my own in South Wales, undertook that kind of public information exercise. In the early March of 1984, however, the National Coal Board appeared to announce the closure of a colliery that was on the safe list, Coughton Wood Colliery in Yorkshire. And the miners in Coughton Wood pretty naturally responded by walking out of work, and the word spread that the National Coal Board had a hit list which included collieries that had been previously deemed to be economically and geologically sound and safe. And that spread. I fully anticipated and naturally spoke to Scargill and to the leaders of the industry in South Wales, who were my friends and very good comrades, and said it would be essential, if there was to be a national strike, that the rules of the National Union of Mine Workers were followed, and there was a national ballot, a pithead ballot, to decide democratically on the course of action. That's exactly what the article in the Miners' Constitution had set down. Scargill ignored that, and at the Easter of 1984, which was an early Easter, had an extraordinary special conference at which it was decided that the strike would go ahead, that there would be no national ballot, and that they would call upon other unions for solidarity. Now, I knew very well, and I think Scargill knew very well, really, that the chances of the strike being really successful in terms of neutralizing at least the NCB approach was going to be extremely difficult, given that without a ballot, there was no democratic mandate for the mining workforce, and secondly, that no other trade unionists would feel an obligation to take sympathetic action, which of course with coal is particularly vital, because it only becomes really effective if you can stop the movements of coal within the country, mainly by rail, and the importation of coal. But other trade unionists felt, well, if the miners haven't had a ballot, there's no reason for me to give up my wages in order to support them, even though there was widespread sympathy. So I was worried about the conduct of the strike from the beginning. And it guaranteed, of course, that without a ballot, there would be a divided workforce, which was pretty lethal. And it did transpire like that. The Nottinghamshire coalfield, with several prosperous working collieries, did not come out on strike. And there were other collieries in Leicestershire, Lancashire, and a few other places that didn't come out either. The result was that Scargill adopted a strategy of mass picketing in order to prevent people going to work. In some cases, that was successful, but not many, because when you challenge working people by saying that we're going to stop you going into work, the reaction to that is obvious and I think pretty natural. So it meant that there had to be a big police presence at collieries and power stations and ports. Now, while all this was going on, long before it, since 1981 indeed, Mrs. Thatcher had made preparations to combat a mining strike. In 1981, without making preparations, she'd conceded to a substantial mining wage increase. And she was very resentful about that and remembered also the memory of 1974 when the then Prime Minister, Ted Heath, conducted a general election on the basis of who governs Britain in order to try and rally electoral support against a miners' strike, where mass picketing featured substantially. So Scargill thought he could repeat that experience. Mrs. Thatcher was determined to resist it. So she had, without making any public announcements, she changed several laws in order to deprive striking workers' families of any form of benefit. She'd organized a national policing system, which was completely unknown in the United Kingdom. We've never had any kind of national police force or coordinating system. We've got about 40 separate police forces. And she'd secured the appointment of an American businessman to the chairmanship of the National Coal Board, a man named McGregor. And she'd also ensured the largest ever stockpile of coal at collieries, power stations, docks, and anywhere that could accommodate great piles of coal. So that by March of 1984, the stockpile of coal in Britain was about 40% higher than it had ever been in any comparable period previously. So she had readied for the strike. She was very happy that they went on strike, but the bonus she got was, of course, the absence of a ballot. She hadn't anticipated that. She thought they would have a ballot and then go on strike, and with the consequence of a divided workforce. So it meant that she literally could divide and rule, organize the police nationally, and rely upon Scargill's demagogic conduct to alienate public support, which it did. So the strike dragged on for a whole year. Politically, of course, it was very damaging to us because of the Labour Party and my specific close association with the miners. I never stood back from that in any shape or form. But in my frequent contact with coal miners and coal mining trade union lodges, especially in my own area, I told people that without a ballot, the strike was doomed. But I couldn't afford to say that publicly because I wasn't going to demoralize the miners and their families, the communities, by appearing to be against what they were doing and not to understand the cause that they were fighting for, to which I and the Labour Party generally, and indeed many other people, were sympathetic because we understood the absolute significance of coal and had a very civilized and economical, productive plan for coal, which we insisted on keeping sustaining presentation to the public. But of course, the strike wore on. Twice in the strike in July 84 and September 84, we had managed to establish a formula which secured the agreement of the National Coal Board leadership. And when we took it to Scargill, he completely dismissed it and insisted that mass picketing would do the job. But of course, it never could in a free society, with people able to make up their own minds, and with devastating poverty inflicted on the coal mining communities. It was pitiful. Then eventually we knew the miners would be starved back to work. I mean, I helped without publicity to raise quite a lot of money to send to the coal mining areas in order to make provision for families, especially for the children. And in my area, that was brilliantly operated by a group of Labour Party women who were superhuman. So it was an appalling experience, damaging politically to us, undermining our ability to earn the trust of the general public. And the resentments lasted. And of course, the damage to the coal mining communities was irreparable. In the wake of the strike, a year after the strike, the coal mining employment in my constituency had gone down from over 4,000 to about 2,000. And the last colliery closed in 1989, despite the fact that there were large deposits of highly valuable coal left in the ground because the new leadership of the coal industry simply wouldn't invest about £5 million to exploit the deposits, which were at that stage worth well in excess of £50 million. So that was the result. And in those communities, family breakup, economic disaster, unemployment, drug taking, social misconduct, tension. In some cases, that still, all these years later, decades later, afflicts those parts of the country. And so the consequence of the strike was, in every respect, utterly appalling. People kept their pride, and I always respected and applauded them for that, and they knew it. But you can't live on pride, and you certainly can't live on revolutionary rhetoric. I said to Scargill in the wake of the strike, I was invited to the Scottish Miners' Gala by Mick McGaughey, who was a dear, dear friend and comrade, who was leader of the Scottish Miners. So I went to the gala, and people were expecting all kinds of trouble because of the stance I'd taken during the strike in calling for a ballot. I didn't call, in my view, as frequently or as loudly as I could and should have. That's always been a regret, but everybody knew where I stood, that without the ballot, the strike was doomed, and it was hell on earth. But I went to the gala. I got nothing but a friendly reception from the miners. And I said to Scargill, who was also a speaker at the big demonstration, that he was unique in the history of trade unions. He'd started a strike with a small house and a big union, and he ended the strike with a small union and a big house. That was the last words we ever exchanged.
And do you consider yourself, and just by ending this because of the Zoom meeting, and because we have like this li limited time, but this is a great talk. Do you consider yourself as the modernizer of the Labour Party? And one more thing is that, what is your definition of socialism? Because I remember that Tony Blair said that socialism was every person having its own car, having a job, and like individual development. So will be your definition of socialism?
Well, it's certainly about individual development. And my view is that all of the activities that we undertake collectively should have as their function, their central aim, individual emancipation. So democratic socialism is a creed for free individualism. But if you want a definition, my view is that all major economic and political decisions should be taken in ways that are consistent with well-being of human society and have to be accountable in order to ensure that that can take place. That's why it's democratic socialism. Tony's definition, I don't think he'd ever thought a lot about it because he's not in any sense ideological, neither am I, certainly not dogmatic. By definition, socialists have to be pragmatic because the world and its realities change. But you have a central body of principles of liberty, solidarity, that mean that you really have to consider your neighbor to be your brother. And in my case, I believe, as do most socialists, that my neighbor is right across the world. And that's even more true now than it's ever been because of the complete interdependence of humanity. Nothing can happen without having an effect at every distance and any distance. And if nothing else proves that, our response to the climate crisis does. But that's not the only sphere in which that understanding of the condition of others and the comprehension that it is a common condition to all of us is absolutely vital. So that's my socialism. As far as modernizing the party is concerned, yes, my efforts were to bring it and its policies and philosophy and presentation up to date. But I always thought of it really in terms of restoring the Labour Party as a trustworthy vehicle for the aspirations of normal people and more generally enlightenment and emancipation. So it was to reinstall those values as central tenets of the Labour Party. Now, of course, a lot of people in the party and the labour movement generally already believed that, but some of those people hadn't crystallized it, thought about it, and weren't asserting it with the confidence that they should. I think by 1992, we'd restored their confidence. So they were very happy to be democratic socialists and not in any sense cowed either by conservatism or by the ultra left, but as people of independent minds and decent commitment.
Well, with those I would say triumphant words, I will close the dialogue by asking you to recommend a film, a book, and a song for the listeners in Spotify.
A film, a book, and what else?
And a song.
All right. Well, the song would have to be, well, you can make a choice. We Shall Overcome, or Sunny Day by Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
The film would either have to be Grapes of Wrath, produced and directed by John Ford in the early 1940s, or Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly. And the book, God damn, there's so much choice.
Jenkins on Churchill.
That was good. It appeared in the same year as Martin Westlake's biography of me. And the general consensus was that had it not been Jenkins, a man of great distinction, on Churchill, a man of great fame, then Martin's book would have won Biography of the Year, because it was is a damn fine book. Now, what book? I think either. Well, I tell you what, if you want to be really bleak, Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, which is really the story, and it is a bleak and bloody story of a gang of men in the southwest of the USA who were mercenaries earning money by the slaughter of Indians. But basically, behind that, it's a story of how empires were made, are made. And that's very bleak. So I'd also recommend Good Expectations by Charles Dickens, because the great story, and I like happy endings. I love happy endings. Or there's a relatively recent book, 2 years ago, I think, How to Be a Liberal, by a man called Ian Dunt. And I recommend that for anybody who wants to be reassured about why they believe what they believe in the most rational and historically accurate way. It's worth reading that.
Well, Neil, this was a great talk. Thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed it. And in 2024, we have general elections on Britain. So maybe we will have you again on the show. Maybe.
Okay, give us a shout. We've also got the general election in the USA, of course, and I'm terrified at the possibility that Trump could win. He's a real
Yes,
bloody stain on humanity.
I think that we are on the same vein. But Keir Starmer, I think he's going to win on the
Well, we can
general
do it. We
election.
can do it.
So, Neil, thank you so much for your time. My name is Facundo Bolaño, and this was another episode of.
Was a sunny day, not a cloud was in the sky, not a negative word was heard from the people's passing by. Was a sunny day, all the birdies in the trees and the radio singing song, all the favorite. Was a Navy man stationed in Newport News. She was a high school queen with nothing really left to lose. She was a high school queen with nothing really left to lose. Was a sunny day. Not a cloud was in the sky, not a negative word was heard from the people's passing by. 'Twas a sunny day, all the birdies in the trees and only girl. She called him Speedo, but his Christian name was Mr. Earl. She called him Speedo, but his Christian name was Mr. Earl. Was a sunny day, not a cloud was in the sky, not a negative word was heard from the peoples passing by. 'Twas a sunny day, all the birdies in the trees, and the radio singing song, all the favorite melodies. Was a sunny day, not a cloud was in the sky, not a negative word was heard from the people passing by.
Diálogos.